Lord, we thank you for giving us this beautiful day, and we thank you for the reminder today that you sent your Son. You sent him here to die for our sins, and we just know that we are not worthy of you doing that for us, but we thank you all the same, and we just pray that those that do not know you would have an opportunity today to come to this church or other churches around the area and be able to hear the word and the gospel spoken. Lord, just be with us as we open up Psalms this morning, that your word would speak to us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So this morning we are going over Psalm 26. When I first volunteered for this psalm, I didn't realize I was volunteering for Easter, which scared me a little bit because I thought, uh-oh, there's going to be lots of visitors, and there are a couple of visitors. But I also realized after last week when James had to do it that all the regulars aren't in here. So I guess I can get away with a lot, right? But feel free to speak up, and if you have any comments or additions. I wanted to start off just reading Psalm 26. There was a couple of things I wanted to talk about so that as we read through it, I want you to kind of keep your mind on that. After we read through it, I then want to go kind of section by section and maybe even verse by verse and share with you some things that I learned. James took his stack of books back out to the car already, but I asked James for a little help with some books, and he had a stack of books about that high he brought me to read through. So that was very good. So a lot of these comments that I may read out are certainly not necessarily mine that I understood directly from this psalm, but The first thing I want you to look at or think about as we're reading through this, there's a lot of commentary about the self-righteous tone of this verse, of this chapter. And as I read through it, I think you'll see some of that, and we'll discuss that a little bit. But the key is to look at verse 11, and that will kind of point out the fact that it really isn't the self-righteous tone being taken there. And so we'll talk about that a little bit. Definitely this psalmist is protesting his innocence about something. I want you to notice that as we're going through that. He's really being defensive about his position. It's thought that this may have been written by David. In fact, I think most of the Bible's mentioned in there that this was a psalm of David. And it's thought that it might have been during the time that he was accused of assassinating Ishbosheth. What happened there, and this is in 2 Samuel 4, I think, is where they said that was. It talks about the fact that Ishbosheth was a son of Saul and was the rightful heir to the throne. After Saul was gone, these two men, Baana and Rechab, went and they murdered Ishbosheth. They even cut off his head and took it to David and said, "Look, now you can be king. Look what we've done for you." And in fact, it's thought that they truly believed that they were an instrument of God going and doing this for David. And David did not hesitate with his reaction, because he knew that God had called him to be king, but he wanted to get to the throne in a righteous manner. And so he actually put those two men to death. And it's thought that this chapter, this was written by David, may have been written because of that scenario. So think of that as we're reading through it. The other thing I want you to read through it from the self-righteous tone thought is, if I stood up here and I said, I have perfect righteousness. And that's basically what this psalm is thinking. And do I have a right to stand up here and say, I have perfect righteousness? In of myself, I do not. But with Christ, I do. And so we'll talk about that a little bit also as we go through the verse. Let me just read through it real quick. And then I have a quote from J. Vernon McGee I'd like to go into also. It says, Psalm 26, vindicate me. Oh, by the way, this I'm reading through the NASB, but as I talk through this, I'm going to quote some of the new King James also, because there's some of the verses that I really liked out of King James instead. But vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, and I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. Examine me, O Lord, and try me. Test my mind and my heart. For your loving kindness is before my eyes, and I have walked in your truth. I do not sit with deceitful men, nor will I go with pretenders. I hate the assembly of evildoers, and I will not sit with the wicked. I shall wash my hands in innocence, and I will go about your altar, O Lord, that I may proclaim with the voice of thanksgiving and declare all your wonders. O Lord, I love the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. Do not take my soul away along with sinners, nor my life with men of bloodshed, in whose hands is a wicked scheme and whose right hand is full of bribes. But as for me, and here's verse 11, but as for me, I shall walk in my integrity, redeem me and be gracious to me. My foot stands on a level place. In the congregation, I shall bless the Lord. And did everybody get, that's the end of Psalm 26, did everybody get an outline? Maddie, do you and the girl go back there in the back and get an outline real quick? Before we start breaking down per verse here, J. Vernon McGee said in his book, A Man's Faith Needs to be backed up by a good life. How important this psalm is in this connection. Hey, Alan. Maybe the reason this section of psalms is not so popular today is because they emphasize a life that is pleasing to God. So that was J. Vernon McGee's quote about this. Alan, we're going through Psalm 26. Okay, cool. So, this, if you look, I titled this "A Plea for Vindication and Protection." The verses at the top half of the verses is the proof of blameless conduct. The psalmist is going through and he's kind of stating his proof of righteousness in his own life, kind of some of his acts and some of the things he tries to avoid in life. And so that's what the psalmist is focusing on in the first half. And then in the second half, he's going to talk about and plea to be spared the fate of evildoers. So after he's proven in his own words why he believes he's lived a righteous life, and we'll talk about that a little more in depth, he wants to then say, okay, but because of that, please don't treat me like the evildoers. I think when we get down there and go into detail, you'll notice that he's rightly concerned about evildoers and where they're going to end up. And he doesn't want to be associated with them, not only while he's on this earth, but also after he's dead in the place that they're going to go after that. So let's start on verse 1. In verse 1, I put in the notes his prayer for justice. He starts off saying, vindicate me. So this is basically a cry of any innocent man, right? I mean, if you're falsely accused of something, and if you think of the psalmist maybe as being David in that time where after that murder went on, he obviously probably heard a lot of people accusing him that, well, you know, you were the one to gain from this, and these were your men that did this, and they brought you the head. You very likely ordered this. David was obviously very concerned about not just what the people around him saw of him, but more concerned, he's crying out to God to vindicate him. And I think this is a good example of what happens with people who do try and walk with the Lord, and then they get accused of things that, you know, they think it probably isn't appropriate, especially if they're innocent of that. The psalmist says, vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, and I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. The King James Version says, instead of vindicate me, it actually says judge me. You know, a lot of times that has a connotation of convict me. And I think that is kind of what David's saying is, look, go ahead and judge me on who I am. Judge me for what I've done. But David's, I think it was Martin Luther that first professed the term vindicate me. And I should have been able to stand up here and say that in German, but I can't. And I sounded foolish to myself trying to do so, so I'm not going to do that. But vindicate me might be a better term for what the psalmist is really trying to say there. He's trying to say, you know, prove me innocent. Through your righteousness, prove me innocent. And I think as you go through this a little more, think about the fact that we each want to be righteous in front of God. We all want to be proven innocent. We all know that we fail and we sin. And if we are walking close to God, then when we do fall and we do make mistakes, it just hurts that much more, not for ourselves, but because we did that in front of our God that sees us. And so I think that's what the psalmist here is crying out for, is for that feeling of, I want to know that you believe me. I want to know that you find me innocent. I want to walk in righteousness. And I think as we'll get to down in verse 11, he's making all these bold proofs that he is righteous. But ultimately he recognizes that, well, I'm only righteous if you say I'm righteous. And it doesn't matter what I claim, because I can deceive myself. And David, if it was David that wrote this, by that point in his life, it was obvious that not only in himself, but in others, it was easy to see that people can fool themselves. I mean, look, if it was this murder that he's talking about, presumably David picked some men that he trusted to be leaders. I mean, these two men weren't just regular guys in the army. They were troop leaders. I mean, they were people that David trusted. And so David, obviously, at this point in his life, had already seen many times where people could convince themselves of things that God wanted them to do. And we have to be careful about that today. I mean, that rings very true. I mean, how many times do you turn on the radio or the TV and see people doing things, professing it as God, as the church, and that they can be deceiving themselves? Did you have something?
I was just going to say, it's pretty evident that David's definitely innocent of this because of whatever he's being accused of. Because how many of us I mean, we know that the Lord knows our heart. How many of us could stand before the Lord and say, judge me, God? And, you know, nine times out of ten, if we did that, we think we might have a cringe of being guilty of the Lord. I'd be a little fearful of how the Lord would judge me. But, you know, the fact that he's standing up there saying, vindicate me, oh Lord, indicates that he's pretty confident that his motives were sincere and righteous.
Right. And if you take this psalm in the specific and assume that David was talking about a specific act, he very well may have been very righteous in everything he did there. And if he was talking about how he gained the throne, he could very well have been saying, look, I was completely righteous in everything I did here. Now, if you take it more in the general, surely David realized that he hadn't been perfect, although probably a lot more perfect than we have been. So that's why it's always really good to read some of David's Psalms and see what he went through. I wanted to read something Matthew Henry wrote. He says, this man desires to have his inmost soul searched and proved by the Lord. He is aware of the deceitfulness of his own heart. He desires to detect and mortify every sin, and he longs to be satisfied of his being a true believer and to practice the holy commands of God. So, the psalmist used the term integrity, or at least the meaning of integrity. It's been interpreted to mean integrity in the English language. He is recognizing that God wants us to have integrity. And that's something we should always use. I mean, we daily walk and have the opportunity to make decisions that in a lot of cases is a choice between what's easy and comfortable to us and what is right by the eyes of the Lord and what allows us to claim our own integrity and allows us to walk in integrity. And David specifically uses that. And then what I thought, the other term he uses is trust. So if you look at this verse, you can split out three words that are important. Integrity, trust, and then without wavering, he says, which is a tough one. But let's talk about trust for just a second. Spurgeon said, this talks of integrity and trust. He says, any man who possesses them both needs not fear the judgment nor the danger of the way. So he's talking here about salvation and of sanctification there. That's what Spurgeon's talking about. So, you know, Kim, you mentioned about David being able to speak so boldly to God. Well, any man who possesses integrity and faith and trust and the Lord has that kind of boldness and is able to stand up and say that, because he doesn't need to, he needs not fear the judgment, he needs not fear his salvation, but he also doesn't need to fear his life and the hard times that are going to happen while he's still here on this earth, the sanctification that he's going to work through. He doesn't have to fear that. And it's also interesting that he says, and I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. So, you know, I think if I was writing this, I'd say, you know, I trusted in the Lord without falling. But David said, look, I didn't even waver. I didn't hesitate. And I think if this is about that murder, it's obvious that as soon as those two men came up, David didn't, oh no, what are we going to do? How do we spin this? Where's my... you know, my political speech guys, how can we write a speech to make this look good? He just said, no, these two guys did wrong. This was not of me. And he put probably some real close friends and trusted leaders to death because of it. Ron, did you have something?
In the Old Testament time, I believe, I don't know if I read it or if it was somewhere I got it out of the Bible, that the kings of Israel were judged good or bad based on not their personal integrity as much as whether or not they carried out God's plan for Israel. So some of them were pretty scalawags, and they were called good kings. And it's because of their doing what God wanted them to do for the nation. They were judged by a slightly different yardstick because they were God's personal representatives for that nation.
That's a good point. James?
It seems also that the words that David is using here, he's comfortable in his relationship with God. Well, he has that confidence.
Yeah.
Because he had a relationship with God.
Right. Right. That's, man, that's one verse. We're going to move a lot faster. Verse 2, examine me, O Lord, and try me. Test my mind and my heart. The King James Version in the second 2B, the second half of that says, try my reins and my heart. And I wanted to point that out because what I believe the psalmist there is really trying to say is, the reins are what, on a horse, the reins is what leads the horse. And so, if you imagine someone's intent, that's like their reins. It's what drives them. It's what makes them do what they do in life. Back in that time, the mind, the word that actually was for mind, could have been translated into kidney at that time, which I found interesting. The thought was that's where that feeling, that's where you actually came about with what you wanted to do. So if you had a sick kidney, you wouldn't do the things that you should do. But if you had a healthy kidney and a close walk with God, then that's what it was talking about. So I like the term reins that's in the King James Version. And then heart, it's hard to read in today's English because we know that heart's not where our thoughts come from, but back then that is what they were, that's what they were referring to, is that your heart is where your actual thought process originated. And so the feeling there was that, you know, not only did I have feelings, it says test not only my intentions, but test my logic behind what I'm doing, which is very interesting. And I have a whole ton of notes that I'm going to skip right past.
Take the pressure off.
Yeah. Verse 3, for your loving kindness is before my eyes, and I have walked in your truth. This is his proof of loyalty. I think the point being made here by almost all of the guys that I read was that David's trust in the Lord was not from his own doings. It was from the loving kindness, the grace that he saw God doing in his life all the time. And so he was able to love the Lord because of the love he knew God had for him ahead of time. I mean, keep in mind, by this point, if David is a psalmist, but probably whoever the psalmist was, knew that God loved him long before he ever loved God. And the point in this verse is exactly that. That because, I mean, you could read this as, because of your loving kindness, because I see your loving kindness for me, not just me, if it's David, my whole country, the Israelites, because I see that in the Lord, that's why I walk in your truth. And I think that's the point he's trying to do, to point out there. I think, well, let me just get that to you. If I don't, I'm never going to get there. Yeah, this is very much the abridged. We're on verse 4, though, because I have a whole lot to say in a little bit. Verse 4 says, I do not sit with deceitful men, nor will I go with pretenders. Now, this is where the I think a lot of people reading it start seeing the self-righteousness in it. David, if it was David, we know that this was probably written a little earlier in life, especially if it was at the time of these murders. This is before he's made at least one very serious mistake in his life. And so it's easy for us to read this and go, oh, David. Don't get too proud, David. But the way he says this, he doesn't seem to shy away from saying it. He says, I do not sit with deceitful men, nor will I go with pretenders. Pretenders is a very interesting term. King James Version uses the term dissemblers, which, does anybody have an opinion of what he was talking about there, pretenders or dissemblers? Hypocrites? I think that's exactly it. I mean, if you think about it, we all have to live in the world, and we're all going to probably have to do business with people that we don't exactly want to do business with. We're going to probably buy services and products from people that we probably don't want to necessarily support. However, I don't think the psalmist is talking about that here in Psalm 4. He's talking specifically about be careful of those who are pretenders. If you go back to the assumption that this is David talking about that murder, these were two men that he had selected, that he had probably had dinner with many times, that he had probably put a lot of faith in, and they went off and did this. After seeing, I mean, the other point here is, remember, while Saul was alive, there was many opportunities David could have taken to take the crown. And so it's, you can't just sit back and think that, oh, these two men, it's no wonder they made this mistake. You know, they thought that David should have been ruler, but I think David had already proven to them many times that he was not taking the shortcut to the crown. So it's one of the things that that we need to really pay attention to. And as we go into the next couple of verses, I think this gets pointed out even more. The other thing I wanted to point out notice the present in the first part of verse 4. Notice the present tense of the sentence. I do not sit with deceitful men. So David's basically saying, this is kind of a proof thing, right? I do not sit with deceitful men. But in the second half of it says, nor will I go with pretenders. So this is David, or the psalmist, basically saying, look, I'm confident that not only do I not sit with deceitful men now, I will not go with pretenders. Yes?
Probably saying also, you know, he didn't know what they were up to.
Yeah. That's a good point. Using the term...
It's present tense.
Right.
You know, he and they had their confidence and all that kind of stuff, and he didn't know that they were going to go through that.
That's a very good point that I hadn't thought about when I was reading through that. I mean, how many times do we sit with people that we think, only to find out later that, they're not exactly who I thought of? Yes, Alan?
There's always a lot of parallelism in the Psalms, and I do not, nor will I, fit in with verse 2 of mind and heart. So it's like what I do in my life now and what my plans are. So it may be relating back to verse 2.
Yes, yes. That's very good. What hit me was just the fact that, and it goes back to what we talked about in the earlier verses, about having that confidence to know that I'm not going to slip, I'm not going to even waver. And having that confidence is something we all want. And I think what this psalmist is proving to us is that if we have a close walk with God, we can achieve that. We can get to the point where we feel comfortable that even in the worst storms, we're going to be able to weather them, and we're going to be able to come out on the other side and be able to claim the kind of things that this psalmist is saying.
And in verse 5 and 6, he continues that in what I have not done and what I plan not to do.
Right.
It just continues on ever since verse 2. He's giving present plans and future plans.
Right, right. And that lets me get into verse 5. I hate the assembly of evildoers, and I will not sit with the wicked. I did a little bit of a word study on this particular verse, and I wanted to do a little experiment here, and I'm going to pick on Maddie down here in the front row. Maddie, if I made up, and I want each of you to think of this, but I'm going to get Maddie to answer me. If I made up a word, and I said, let's say I make up a word called sauna. You don't know what sauna is, right? As far as you're concerned, I made that word up, right? Okay. And Maddie's my daughter, for those of you that don't know. So if, as she's around me, she sees me take a bowl of spinach and push it away from me and say, I sauna spinach. Man, I can't eat this. I sauna spinach. And then later, she sees me outside working, and I get a little bit of a sunburn, or I go in, and let's say I don't get a sunburn, I go in and I put a lot of sunscreen on, because I say I sauna having a sunburn. I just can't have a sunburn. I'm going to put on some sunscreen. Or maybe she hears me or sees me not going to rated R movies, and she hears me say one time, I sauna going to rated R movies. Maddie, what would you guess that word sauna really means? Or you hate it? Well, the sauna actually is the word that got interpreted to hate here in the Bible. But what we want to point out here is that what sometimes we view in today's times in English as hate maybe is a little stronger word than what would have been used here. I think the psalmist is trying to say, I stay away from. I don't want to be around. I don't tolerate. Maybe I don't tolerate is a better word here. It's not the kind of hate where it says, I hate evildoers, therefore I'm going to, you know, beat them up anytime I get a chance. I'm going to shoot them if I get a chance. I want to burn them at the stake if I get a chance. That's not what the term is meant to be, and that's not what the psalmist was trying to say. But he certainly wanted it made clear that I don't tolerate it. So, not for his life, nor does he go and sit with them and allow them to tolerate it. I kept going back to the thoughts of, well, you know, Jesus sat with evildoers, he sat with sinners. But I think if you look back at those stories of when he's sitting with them, he's sitting them with them, not tolerating the kind of life that they're living. He's not in any way encouraging them to believe that he approves of what they're doing. And I think that's something that we can take to heart as we go through this life. We're going to deal with people that we don't agree with. In fact, we probably even love some of the people that we don't agree with. But we just have to be able to make it clear that I don't tolerate it and go from there. So that's I think, one thing the psalmist is saying. All right, verse 6. I shall wash my hands in innocence, and I will go about your altar. It's interesting that he mentions, I will go about your altar here. Some of the commentary that I was reading thought that one of the things David was saying here was kind of taking a shot at some of the priests and the Pharisees at this point, even in his time, that would go up to the altar to sacrifice, and they'd go over to water and wash their hands. And that was supposed to be symbolic of coming to God clean and pure, but that the priests could easily, and we can easily, lean on those outward expressions as that's all it takes. Let me just go wash my hands, and then, you know, I can approach God, which is what David is saying in the second half of this verse. He's saying, I wash my hands not in water, but in my own innocence. In my own actions, in the proof that I've stated before, that's what I'm washing my hands in. And I'm doing so that I can come close to you. And that's what David's mentioning there. All right. And then as he starts going to the altar, the verses kind of change. And you move into verse 7, that I may proclaim with the voice of thanksgiving and declare all your wonders. So at the end of 6 and 7, he's talking about, you know, I do all of this so that I can have a better relationship with you. And as part of having that relationship, I can proclaim with the voice of thanksgiving. So proclaim being like today, we have the perfect opportunity, you know. He is risen. You can go into Sack and Pack today and just say he is risen and see what kind of response you get back. But that's not to stop us from proclaiming his word. So that's what David's talking about. By the way, I was in Sack and Pack and didn't say it. But I thought about it after I left. So and declare all your wonders. God's wonders are all around us, easy for us to see. But not necessarily easy for the lost to see. So I think we can always remember that it does the lost good when we declare God's wonders, maybe point them out a little bit. Verse 8, O Lord, I love the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. Again, this is going right along with 7. This is the psalmist saying, I love being near you. I love being in your house. And the thought that I got out of this is, you know, we do a lot of things daily that we don't necessarily consider evil. We do a lot of things daily that are maybe comforting to ourselves, but aren't necessarily walking with God. And, you know, I like to think, is God offended when we don't spend that time with him? And keep that in mind as you, as I take my nap this afternoon or whatever. I need to keep that in mind. Verse 9. All right, I'm doing good, James. I'm catching up. Do not take my soul away along with sinners, nor my life with men of bloodshed. Now, this one I can talk about for a while. enforcement. When he says, do not take my soul away along with sinners, I mean, he's talking directly about salvation there, isn't he? I mean, he's talking directly about, at least when we read it today as meaning, when I die, don't take my soul away. I like this. Spurgeon said this, which I couldn't have. I hate saying something and then reading him. But, Lord, when like fruit I must be gathered, put me not in the same basket with the best of sinners, much less with the worst of them. Spending eternity with sinners would be too much to take, is what he's basically saying. And I think the psalmist would say, if the psalmist that we've read the previous eight verses with that says, I don't sit with evildoers, if he doesn't want to do that now in this short life, why would he want to do that in eternity? And that's a good reminder for us there. Yes, Alan?
I think the clarification that needs to be made that David's not saying, don't take my soul away from my body. He's saying, don't separate my soul from you. Because you might get the idea, along with sinners, well, is that saying that those in hell don't have a soul anymore? Well, yes, they do. But hell is separation.
Very good.
So, take away is in reference to God.
Thank you for that. That's very good. That's very good.
You know, and also, this is pre-Christ, you know, salvation is a little different than they understand at that point. But yet they still understand there's this separation from the Lord with your soul, you know, at death for those who are the sinners, those who are walking.
But the psalmist, if we read on in verse 9, the psalmist is making two points here. He's saying, do not take my soul away. And then he says, nor my life with the men of bloodshed. So, I mean, we could almost say, okay, you know, in the first half he's talking about salvation. In the second half he's definitely talking about sanctification. If, you know, if you're a believer in God and you know that when my life is over, I get to go and be with Him, then he's not scared of God when he says, don't, nor my life. I don't think he's saying, don't kill me and take me now. He's saying, don't allow my life to account to nothing for you. Allow me to continue to glorify you while I'm on this earth. Allow my life to mean something as I continue. So that's what I got out of those schools. Okay, the last 10. In whose hands is a wicked scheme? Okay, so he's referencing what he talks about along with sinners and men of bloodshed. In whose hand is a wicked scheme, and whose right hand is full of bribes? Again, he's just referencing the people that he doesn't want to be compared to, doesn't want to be associated with. And then we get to verse 11, finally. But as for me, I shall walk in my integrity. Again, a very very confident statement from the psalmist. But then he turns and he says, redeem me and be gracious to me. So even with all this confidence, even with all this proof that he has listed out above, none of that matters if God doesn't redeem me. None of that matters without God's action, meaning our actions don't account to anything without God choosing to redeem us and be gracious to me. He ends up recognizing that it is gracious. I mean, think about that. If this was a self-righteous psalm, if this was a person who felt he was perfect in every way, would he be asking for grace? No, I don't think so. I think the psalmist already realizes, yeah, I'm claiming my righteousness here, but I also know that even as righteous as I can claim to be, I can't get to heaven with that righteousness. It's not going to matter if you don't show me grace and if you don't choose me. So that's verse 11. In verse 12, I like verse 12 says, my foot stands on a level place. Before I go on and finish that, my foot stands on a level place refers to in our walk with light in life, and this is really good. My wife will love this one. So I drove a heavy backhoe over our nice front yard about 30 times the last 2 days. So you can't say that our front yard is a level place. And so if you walk across it, you're very likely to stumble and fall. And I think the psalmist is saying here, I stand in a level place where I can walk through my life without fear of stumbling and falling. The kids convinced me to go play Ultimate Frisbee yesterday. And I've got a little bit of a bad knee. And I have not run in a long time, but primarily because most of the running I've done has been with the kids down in our back pasture trying to play capture the flag and stuff. And there's holes everywhere where the cows step, and you stumble and you run and your knee pops out. And we got to play on a public football field yesterday that our taxes pay to keep perfectly level, and it is nice. You can run without fearing stumbling. You can run without fearing that pain of having the unexpected happen to you. And I think that's what the psalmist is talking about. My foot stands on a level place. And it's a place we all want to be, knowing that we can walk through life without any fear of falling. And that's where he is. And then he says, In the congregations I shall bless the Lord. And he goes back to a relationship with God. He goes back to, as I'm living in and walking on this level place, I can walk with you, in congregation with you and the Lord, and be able to focus on that and not be able to focus on, well, am I going to slip? Am I going to fall? Am I going to get hurt? And that's where that is. I did okay in time. Any comments before we close? Alan, would you close us? Thank you.